fact. No one disputes the fact that Carl Dorsey was unarmed when he was shot and killed at near point-blank range by Detective Rod Simpkins of the Newark Police Department. In New Jersey, we have this independent prosecutor bill where if a police, if a local police person kills someone, then the state attorney general must take over that investigation. The state attorney general had this case for 2 years, and we didn't hear anything publicly. And then this week, almost on the same day that the officers that killed Tyree Nichols were charged, that day the grand jury came back with no bill, no indictment for the officer that killed Carl Dorsey. So today at 11 a.m., together with the family members of Carl Dorsey, their attorney, Robert Tarver, we're going to have a press conference at 11 a.m. in front of the Rodino Federal Building in Newark, 970 Broad Street in Newark, New Jersey, to demand that the U.S. Attorney, the United States Attorney for the District of New Jersey, Philip Selinger,
we have 5 seconds,
launch a civil rights investigation into the death of Carl Dorsey.
Well, Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress, and D. Ray McKesson, civil rights activist, executive director of Campaign Zero. Thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders rally to condemn the police killing of Tyree Nichols, Northwest residents face rising gas bills with no end in sight, and the National Prayer Breakfast is under new management. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 30th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Portlanders rallied Friday night to condemn the Memphis police killing of Tyree Nichols. A crowd of around 150 gathered under the Burnside Bridge on the east side of the river, calling for justice for Tyree Nichols and drawing parallels to other protests against police killings of unarmed black men. Nichols was pulled over in a traffic stop and brutally beaten by police on January 7th in Memphis. He died in the hospital 3 days later. Five police officers that were involved now face serious charges, including murder and kidnapping. The crowd kept mostly to the sidewalks, but briefly closed the Burnside Bridge as they crossed into downtown Portland. The police violence that met racial justice protesters in Portland in 2020 was not present, though some cops in riot gear were around the Multnomah County Justice Center. Some people knocked over road barriers, but there were no major clashes with police. Protesters chanted, "No justice, no peace, whose lives, black lives, and say his name, Tyree Nichols." They dispersed peacefully. Natural gas customers across the West Coast are being met with an unsettling surprise when they open their gas bills this winter. So far this year, natural gas costs have soared between 15 and 25%, and these numbers are expected to keep increasing. In just over a year, Northwest Natural customers will see their bills jump roughly 40%. KBOO's Isabel Charlet tells us why. There are a number of reasons why natural gas prices are skyrocketing. One reason is that liquefied natural gas, or LNG, has become more of a global commodity. Bob Jenks, the executive director of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, says that in recent years, exports from North America have been increasing, and now even more with the war in Ukraine.
There was a big push to help Europe deal with its losing gas from Russia by having the U.S. Push as much gas as we can through our exports to Europe, and that's affected prices here quite a bit.
With increase in exports, LNG is not only more tied to the world market, but also to world weather patterns and climate change.
We can expect to pay higher gas prices as we go forward, and we can expect to see a lot more volatility. A harsh winter in Europe will cause gas prices to go up here.
Increased costs of maintenance and building new natural gas infrastructure are also pushing rates up. On top of that, state gas utilities are required to cut emissions by 50% by 2035 in order to meet Oregon's carbon emission regulations. For Northwest Natural, that means paying to replace their conventional natural gas with a whole new product coming through the pipes, so-called renewable gas. What is renewable gas? It's made by capturing the methane that off-gases from wastewater treatment plants, landfills, and factory farms, then cleaning it up so it can go through a pipeline. Building the infrastructure needed for this process doesn't come cheap.
And those price increases are also going to be, quite frankly, staggering. The cost of renewable natural gas that Northwest Natural is starting to bring to its system is three to five times as much as conventional gas. And they need to bring in a lot of it.
Supplies of this methane are limited, so gas companies plan to go to other sources as well, such as thermal gasification.
That would come from taking things like forest waste and agricultural waste and things like this and converting that to methane. And that's the stuff that's going to cost as much as 10 times the cost of the conventional gas we've been burning.
Seems like with these dramatic price increases that aren't going away anytime soon, added with the immense financial investment that's going to be needed in order to keep Oregon and the West Coast cooking with natural gas and its expensive cousins, maybe we should consider something else? Instead, Northwest Natural is doubling down on keeping the West Coast hooked on gas by continuing to build more pipes and planning to add almost 140,000 new customers.
That's their plan, is to keep, they believe they can keep adding customers like they were in the past, that historic growth patterns on the gas system will continue. To me, that's absurd.
Bob says Northwest Natural's strategy is setting up low-income households and renters to bear the ever-increasing costs. As government subsidies and rising rates encourage more households to switch to electric, low-income households could be left to pay for the newly built, newly antiquated natural gas infrastructure.
And so that's why we think we ought to be working to get the customers, particularly focusing on low-income customers, and try to get them at the head of the line for electrification.
Plans are already in the works to do just that. In the next few months, the Oregon Department of Energy, as well as the federal government, will be implementing programs to subsidize moderate and low-income households to replace their natural gas with heat pumps.
When the federal government's paying for you to go to electricity with your appliances in your home, with cities like Eugene and Milwaukee talking about banning gas in new buildings and in new homes, the movement away from gas has started.
That was Bob Jenks with the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, and I'm Isabel Charlet with KBOO News.
Over 600 Portland City employees in the Portland City Laborers Union plan to strike on Thursday if no agreement is reached with the city in their contract bargaining. These workers include people who work in wastewater treatment, sewer repair, parks maintenance, and snow and ice transportation. Their contract with the city expired last summer, and bargaining has been ongoing since last March. They say a needed cost of living increase amidst rising inflation is where the sides are at an impasse. Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency in reaction to the strike announcement. That allows the city to prepare to hire contractors to fill the striking workers' roles and reassign other city workers. After the mass shootings in California earlier this month, one activist group is aiming to reframe the conversation around crime and punishment. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Social justice advocates have just launched a new public education campaign. It's called Just Safe, and it's aimed at changing the conversation about crime, especially in the wake of the recent mass shootings. The group Californians for Safety and Justice has released a commercial narrated by actress Jennifer Lewis, making the point that safety isn't just the absence of crime, it is the presence of well-being. The group's executive director, Tanish Hollins, says these shootings and others plague a society that neglects mental health.
So the goal of this is to invite conversation about doubling down on investments that lead to well-being, like mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, education.
The campaign applauds efforts to heal communities, such as the announcement last week from the California Victims Compensation Board of a $2.5 million grant to open 3 new trauma recovery center offices in Stockton and Bakersfield. The state's 19 trauma recovery centers offer mental health treatment, help with medical expenses, and support groups for victims of violent crime. While accountability is important for people involved with the justice system, Hollins says she agrees with the state's efforts in recent years to prioritize rehabilitation over punishment. She calls post-incarceration programs that help people reenter society a wise investment.
Removing barriers, making sure that they have the resources they need when they return home, keeps us all safe, prevents more crime from happening, and helps our economy because we have more folks to be able to play a role.
She notes, right now, people who've paid their debt to society often fail to recover when they face huge obstacles to finding employment and housing and must comply with onerous legal requirements. Find out more about the campaign online at justsafe.org. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Civil rights activists are again pushing the Justice in Policing Act in Congress following the police murder of Tyre Nichols. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We now have the blueprint, America, and we won't accept less going forward in the future.
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump says any officer engaged in police brutality should be met with fair justice. 5 black police officers were fired and charged with murder right after the death of 29-year-old Tyre Nichols of Memphis. Crump cited the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which passed the House in 2021 and would ban chokeholds and racial profiling. But the new Republican chair of House Judiciary says no legislation would prevent police violence.
Why wouldn't we sit down now, set a path to get us to a balanced budget, and let's start paying this debt off and make sure the future generation has as many opportunities as we do?
Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he and President Joe Biden could reach a deal on deep budget cuts when they meet this week on the debt ceiling. McCarthy did concede that cuts to Social Security and Medicare are off the table despite pressure from his right. The U.S. hit its debt limit earlier this month. Treasury officials say they can prevent default until summer. Observers say 2023 will be a crucial year for voting rights.
Those on the other side are trying to discourage people from participating. That's what this really is about. We have to fight back to protect our democracy, to protect everything.
Maine Secretary of State Shayna Bellows says it'll take strong leaders to ward off systematic voter suppression. Nearly 100 bills to restrict voter access have been introduced in state houses nationwide. More than 245 bills would expand voter access or otherwise deal with election administration. A Democratic National Committee panel says it will finalize its presidential primary calendar in June. Officials in Georgia and New Hampshire say they want the extra time to adjust if South Carolina goes first. But some lawmakers, like New Hampshire Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen, are pushing back.
Now, we have a state law that says we're going to go first, so we're going to go first.
Shaheen says she'll continue to invite presidential hopefuls to her state despite a plan to penalize candidates if they ignore the new schedule. Under a DNC plan backed by President Biden, Nevada and New Hampshire would follow South Carolina. Georgia would be third, followed by Michigan. Activists on both sides are focused on Wisconsin, where a state Supreme Court seat could determine the fate of abortion rights in the swing state. Voters will head to the polls next month to choose which of 4 candidates, 2 liberal and 2 conservative, will move on to the general election in April. Political analysts say the GOP handed Democrats a winning issue by proposing to replace the income tax with a nationwide 30% sales tax. That would land harder on working families, but be a big break for the wealthy. Kevin McCarthy says he opposes the bill, but promised a vote to win the speaker's chair. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on one of the progressive groups urging Biden not to run for re-election. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cold with an overnight low of 22 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be similarly cold with some cloud cover and a daytime high of 41. Today in history, in 1969, the Beatles performed for the last time publicly on the rooftop of Apple Studios in London. The concert was broken up by police. The quote of the day is from American President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was born on this day in 1882. He said, quote, "In these days of difficulty, we Americans everywhere must and shall choose the path of social justice, the path of faith, the path of hope, and the path of love toward our fellow man." Montana legislature would renew a task force on missing and murdered indigenous people that is set to expire. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to renew funding for Montana's missing and murdered indigenous persons task force recently passed through the Appropriations Committee in the state legislature. The task force was created in 2019, but was set to expire in June. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin reports.
According to research from the U.S. Department of Justice, Montana is the fifth highest state in the country for total missing and murdered indigenous women. And despite only being 7% of the total population in the state, 26% of missing persons cases are indigenous people. Representative Tyson Running Wolf, a member of the Blackfeet Nation, is the bill's sponsor. Addressing the committee, Running Wolf said the work of the MMIP task force is ongoing and crucial for addressing this issue in Montana.
I'm not realizing it until I'm standing up here now that this is what it means to be fighting for our women and children and our loved and missing people.
The task force was set to expire this year, but the bill would fund it through the biennium. This bill also includes funding for one full-time employee to help facilitate the work of the task force and funding for the Looping in Native Communities Grant Program, which supports tribes' efforts to identify, report, and find Native American persons who are missing. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
Opening ceremonies for the Arctic Winter Games got underway in Alberta, Canada, Sunday night. The games have brought more than 2,000 athletes and coaches from 7 Arctic nations together to compete in winter sports like cross-country skiing, curling, and hockey, as well as traditional games. Alaska, which represents the United States, sent more than 200 athletes to compete. They range in age from 11 to 19.
My team is really great. They're really supportive, and it's really fun to skate with them.
Teamwork is a big part of Josephine Leonard's Alaska Native culture, a skater of Yupik and Chupik heritage. She's excited about the chance to compete with other Indigenous athletes. After watching past competitions, she's paying a lot more attention to her technique.
How I swing my arms, how low I am, how aerodynamic I am, how I drive my knees, how I cross over around the corner, all that stuff.
Leonard is 13 and hopes to bring home an ulu, a medal shaped like a carving knife. They come in gold, silver, and bronze. John Monroe, the coach for the Alaska Speed Skating Team, is not sure they'll bring home any ulus. He says the competition will be tough to beat, partly because the pandemic cut into their training. Also, teams from other countries like Canada get more financial support. But Monroe says there's more involved in the games than just winning.
What has been good to see is that their competitive spirit is super high, and they don't know how good they're going to do, but they're going to have fun.
The games are held every other year, but there has not been one in 5 years due to the pandemic. Alaska is slated to host the next round of games. On Tuesday, the Cherokee Nation will unveil plans for an addiction treatment center to be built in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Construction of the $18 million project will start this year. Plans include a main treatment center with separate dorms for men and women. Tribal leaders will detail more mental health plans under the Public Health and Wellness Fund Act, which will be signed into law during the event. It will provide $73 million to construct facilities across the reservation over the next 5 years to meet behavioral health service needs and provide $5 million in scholarships to encourage more Cherokee citizens to enter behavioral health fields. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The National Prayer Breakfast is splitting off from the private religious group that has overseen it for decades. This comes following concerns that the gathering has become too divisive. The National Prayer Breakfast Foundation will be the organizer and host for this year's breakfast, scheduled for Thursday of this week. Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, is a regular participant and chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee. He said the move was prompted in part by concerns that members of Congress didn't know important details about the large multi-day gathering. The annual event takes place over several days, has attendance measured in the thousands, and requires a very large and somewhat complex underlying organization. Coons said he had questions about who was invited and how it was being funded. Even those in leadership didn't seem to know the answer to those questions. That led lawmakers to decide to take over organizing the prayer breakfast itself. Former Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas is the president of the new foundation. Pryor said the COVID-19 shutdown gave members a chance to reset the breakfast and return it to its origins. He says this change has been discussed for years. Pryor said, quote, "The whole reason the House and Senate wanted to do this was to return it to its roots, when House members and Senate members can come together and pray for the president, pray for his family and administration, pray for our government, the world," end quote. He anticipates between 200 and 300 people attending. Pryor also hopes the smaller event will resemble some weekly non-denominational prayer gatherings held on Capitol Hill. Groups of senators and representatives have long met unofficially for fellowship and to temporarily set aside political differences. The prayer breakfast has been held for 70 years. Dwight D. Eisenhower was the first president to attend in February 1953, and every president since has spoken at the gathering. The larger event, put on by a private religious group called the International Foundation, has always been centered around, quote, "the person and the principles of Jesus, with a focus on praying for leaders of our nation and from around the world," end quote. Earlier this month, the Freedom From Religion Foundation sent a letter asking the White House and members of Congress to boycott the event because of the questions about the International Foundation. The organization's co-president, Annie Laurie Gaylor, said the foundation's basic concerns with the breakfast remain, despite the split with the larger religious gathering. Gaylor said, "National Prayer Breakfast appears to be a quasi-governmental gathering which sends a message that the United States is a Christian nation." The Food Not Feed Summit is coming to Washington, D.C. next week. It focuses on shifting federal food programs to nutritious food and sustainably raised livestock. Farm advocates say that the upcoming reauthorization of the Farm Bill is an opportunity to support local farmers and regional food systems. Nadia Ramlagan has more in Ohio.
Next week, Ohio farmers and their advocates head to Washington, D.C. to push for shifting federal programs toward growing nutritious food as lawmakers gear up to reauthorize the Farm Bill. The cost of groceries has increased by 13% over the past year, driven largely by global supply chain issues and the war in Ukraine. Angela Heffman with the group Farm Action says she believes a strong system of local food suppliers would stabilize Ohio's food economy and help ensure that more families have access to fruits, vegetables, and sustainably raised meat.
The Farm Bill matters to everybody because everybody eats. And a large part of the reason that we're seeing this skyrocketing inflation and frankly price gouging is because a small number of really large corporations are controlling our food system and our government policies.
According to an Urban Institute report, around 1 in 5 adults nationwide reported food insecurity in their households in 2020, and again last summer when historic inflation levels sent food prices soaring. Huffman adds the federal government currently purchases food from major industrial producers. She's hoping the new Farm Bill shifts some of that buying power to local farmers for schools, hospitals, and other community institutions.
The bulk of the money is going toward feed grains, for livestock, which is corn, soybeans, other grains. So farmers are really locked in this system because that's where the lifeline subsidies are directed towards, and their margins are so slim.
Huffman says farmers are struggling to stay afloat in an era of falling commodity prices and the globalization of agriculture.
We want to be focused on empowering farmers to do what they do and feed their neighbors and not just feeding corporate-controlled livestock around the world.
Federal data show in 2019, the nation's small family farm operations held an average of $90,000 in debt. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
Extreme rainfall exacerbates a pollution threat from an Oklahoma Superfund site. Decades-old abandoned lead and zinc mines in Ottawa County are posing lingering health risks to nearby residents, particularly as the threat of flooding increases. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For generations, the ground beneath Ottawa County, Oklahoma, was mined for lead and zinc. The mines closed half a century ago, but some of the pollution they created remains. In the 90s, almost a third of children living nearby had unhealthy levels of lead in their blood. And despite cleanup efforts by the EPA, heavy metal contamination still plagues some areas.
Tar Creek is an 11-mile creek that runs through one of the largest lead and zinc abandoned mine sites.
Rebecca Jim directs Lead Agency, an environmental justice group. She says mounds of mining waste, up to 200 feet high, still sit along the creek bank. When it rains, toxic particles dissolve into the water and seep into the soil. During floods, the contaminated water can spill into downstream areas. And the danger is growing as climate change brings more extreme rain. Her group worked with researchers to create maps that show residents the locations of mine waste and the areas at risk during a 100-year flood.
First of all, they find their house, and then they find their mother's house.
She hopes the maps can help people advocate for action to protect their communities. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A federal food assistance program for people living on reservations doesn't provide culturally relevant foods to every tribe. A pilot program in Washington is bringing locally caught salmon to the program for tribes in the northwest part of the state. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Under a new project, locally sourced food is part of a food assistance program for members of the Lummi tribe in northwest Washington. The Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations is a federal program that provides meals in the form of commodity boxes for low-income residents. But food boxes have neglected to include culturally relevant food for the diversity of reservations across the country, instead providing options like catfish and buffalo. Lummi Nation is part of a pilot that provides a locally caught option, sockeye salmon. Billy Matibo with Lummi Nation says salmon is food his ancestors ate, and members of the tribe know how to prepare, unlike buffalo.
Shifting the mind frame, the mindset to food sovereignty, we should be in charge of saying what is appropriate for our people.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture awarded eight tribes, including the Lummi Nation, with $3.5 million for a demonstration project to provide local food options to the Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations. This fall, sockeye salmon became available for the Northwest Washington tribe. The Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations is meant to supplement meals for participating households. However, a 2016 study found the program was the sole or primary source of food for 40% of those households. Jake Garcia with Northwest Harvest says many folks from the Lummi Nation have spoken to his organization about the program's inadequacies.
The economic insecurity that they experience, the food insecurity, certainly, all these different pieces are indicators for economic success. They're directly tied to your food. And so when that program is insufficient and not meeting the needs of the folks on the reservation, that's a real problem.
But Matiba says the allowance for more locally sourced food in the program is a good sign.
When they funded this program, it's like giving us access to go out and harvest our own food that we've always harvested for as long as I could remember, for as long as my grandparents could remember. And it's important that we pass this down to our kids, because without this, without fighting for something, it eventually will be lost.
The original demonstration project was funded through the 2018 Farm Bill. Tribal leaders across the country hope lawmakers in Congress will broaden the project in the 2023 Farm Bill. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 30th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Catherine Carley, Nadia Ramagon, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Although it's common for presidents to run for re-election, not everyone is always happy with the incumbent. That's definitely the case with the current president, Joe Biden. The progressive activist group Roots Action is sponsoring a campaign urging Biden not to run for a second term. KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Roots Action political director Sam Rosenthal.
Okay, so Joe.